I'll take responsibility for this. Welcome everyone. I'm sure many of you have already attended courses this week, but if you haven't, a special welcome to you. My name is Ingrid Fisk. I work at Extramural Studies, and I'm delighted to invite you to attend and listen and respond to these two lectures on the work of the important South African writer Zeks Mdaa. Some of you might have heard him give a talk at summer school some years ago. Has anyone here who did? So you will have heard he spoke on magic realism and he spoke on his work. It was probably 5 or 6 years ago. But today I'm pleased to introduce you to his interpreter, not to him, his interpreter, Associate Professor Gail Fincham, whose recent book, Dance of Life, The Novels of Zeks Mdaa in Post-Apartheid South Africa, has just been published by UCT Press and Ohio Press, State University Press, and I know that the book is available at the bookstore and Clark's bookstore upstairs. I also know that Gail Fincham, who's recently retired from UCT for many years of teaching in the English department, is actually not really retired from UCT. She's been teaching there while it had some staffing shortages, and I'm sure will be in and out teaching again. She has long experience of teaching at UCT. She was also head of department there, which meant that she had a great number of administrative responsibilities, but was also able to continue doing research, academic research, especially into Joseph Conrad, for instance, who is one of her major research foci. She teaches a lot of courses on modernism and postmodernism, and a course called Romance to Realism, as well as having these very particular focus on post-colonial work and on Zeks Mdaa himself. Now, I understand Zeks Mdaa indicated on Facebook or Twitter that this course was taking place. Did any of you see that? So you're not here as a result of his own advertising. But anyway, we welcome him in absentia. We'll have to let him know. And of course, please welcome Gail Fincham.
Hi everybody, it's very, very nice to welcome you here, especially in the meltdown of the heat wave. I'll start by just showing you the poster which UCT Press, the wrong way around, brought out for Dance of Life, which I was very happy with because it... The cover illustration by Leslie Charmock, she's here at the Montebello Centre, and I fell in love with the painting and was very pleased when she said we could have it. And both UCT Press and Ohio have used the painting for their editions of the book, so that is grand. In fact, not only Leslie Charnock, but also the woodcarvers of Montebello figure in the book, because I fell in love with the wood carvings and we took a photo of them and they're there next to the contents. So it is on sale. The wonderful thing for me, if anybody buys it, is the chance of discussing things with you, because what I find frustrating is, you know, to have to do a couple of lectures with only, you know, 10 minutes of questions or commentary. And I would love to just, you know, sit down and talk to you about your responses to Zeks. So if you
do buy the book, maybe we can make a plan to talk about it, or maybe if you don't buy the book but you just want to talk about Zeks, that's also wonderful, because I very much come out of a sort of collaborative teaching position at UCT where, you know, rather than just lecturing at people, I particularly enjoy dialogues with conversations with people in the group. So, you know, maybe that's a possibility for the future. But just to introduce you, I will leave sort of 10, 15 minutes at the end for questions and comments. but I want to just touch on a few things, starting off by asking who is Zaik Samdar, why is he important, what does he write about, what are the rewards for us as readers in engaging with his work. So I'm going to just read you the very brief introduction in my book. Zaik Samdar was born Zanimvula Kizito Kadieni in 1948 in the Eastern Cape. He spent his childhood in Soweto and then moved to Lesotho to join his father in exile. One of South Africa's foremost writers, he has produced plays, novels, poems, and academic articles, in addition to being a musician and graphic artist. And that's really the point of the title of the book, Dance of Life. It's all about the performing arts. It's all about music and singing and dance and the relationship between that and community, which is very, very central to Zaik's. He's now, as I'm sure you know, Professor of Creative Writing at Ohio, but he comes back quite often, makes frequent trips to his native South Africa to launch his novels. And last year he came back because Penguin was bringing out Black Diamond, and he gave some interviews and was on hand for that. But one of the most important things he does when he's back in South Africa is actually to visit the communities that he works amongst. And there's a very extraordinary, very interesting community, which is the beekeeping project on the Pink Mountain. And, Zaik grew up in that part of the Eastern Cape and always loved the light effects on the mountain, and went there and thought, what could he do to enhance the life of the local community? And so he decided to keep bees and to train the women in beekeeping and honey making. And they now own the cooperative. This is a true story. And it feeds into a lot of his work. For instance, in Ways of Dying, you've got, or in The Madonna of Excelsior, you have Nikki and the bees. The autobiography that he wrote, Sometimes There Is a Void, is, obviously his own life, but feeds into his fiction in many ways, and exhibits one of his most striking characteristics, which is the sense of a place, the importance of place. Because from place, his characters grow. Another thing which comes out of the autobiography very much is the idea that you can't separate writing from community, from the whole nature of building community, which is very, very central to him. So, as I'm sure you know, his name has been linked to a number of African writers like Achebe, Soyinka, Ngugi, Andre Brink, Njibula Ndebele, J.M. Kutsir, Vladislavich, Anki Kroch, Etienne van Heerden. So, quite an illustrious literary set of connections. But just to pick up on a couple of things there, the sense of place is absolutely where Mdar starts, because because when I'm thinking about a novel, I need to know the place where it's set, because out of that place I begin to think about, who are the people who would live here? What would they do? And then the whole plot comes out of that. Equally important is the sense of community, the way in which ordinary people, and this is actually very, very central to Imdar, he's not writing about, you know, highly literate, educated, university-type people. He's writing about peasantry, ordinary people. He wrote for many years his plays about democracy for ordinary people. What is absolutely essential in that commitment to community is the involvement with performing arts. You know, he's come out of a whole tradition of many years of writing theatre for democracy, teaching people, writing with people rather than for people, you know, helping them to express their own needs and their own understandings. All of that is very crucial. Another point which I think is important to Zex is the idea that music and drama and art have always been very central to him. So in the autobiography, sometimes there is a void. He describes living in Johannesburg as a 12-year-old, soon to be banished by his parents from the seductions of city life in a small country town. His father was serving articles under Matanzima and the Transkei. His mother was working as a registered nurse and midwife at the Dobsonville Clinic. Instead of concentrating on schoolwork, Imdar entertained himself with music and drawing. So this is directly from the autobiography. While my mother, who was at work in the clinic, which is just across the street from our house, or cycling in the township delivering babies, I was playing truant from school and hanging out at the shop, where I played the penny whistle with other delinquent youths. On the occasions when I did go to school, I spent most of the class time drawing pictures. My talent was recognized when the teacher asked me to illustrate the poetry we were studying with appropriate pictures, and I drew a Zulu warrior as an illustration for a poem in his praise. With crayons, I brought his traditional sense dress of leopard skins and shield to life. Then I signed the picture at the bottom right by Zex, the artist. And he also writes about music in Lesotho, when he goes back and he finds and makes contact with the records that his father left for him. Frank Sinatra, Marian Anderson, The Beatles, King Kong, Ella Fitzgerald, Satchmo, Handel's Messiah, Dark City Sisters, Jim Reeves, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and 30 or so other vinyl records that my father used to collect when he was a member of a record club from 1963 to 1966. So from the very beginning, art and music were central activities for Imdar, and they spill over effortlessly into his writing life. I want to say a little bit about the first novel that we're looking at, which is Ways of Dying, 1995, on the eve of the new South Africa. So a text about transition and cultural crisis, a lot of social realism, but also the magic realism that you've heard him speak about, and the liberating potentials of the creative imagination. So immediately you're into Zex's novels, you think about what an extraordinary choice of setting and characters and theme to create a novel of hope and growth, because it's a pretty grim and gruesome setting. That's we're talking about apartheid squatter community, characterized by, I've said, violence and horror and death, and yet it's a novel about community, Ubuntu, agency, and life. So how do you get to that from the first set of terms? Because we're talking about legislated brutality, the brutality of township life. I put a bit in which possibly we all know about, but is not taken for granted by overseas readers, that just to do with the growth of the National Party, the institutionalized racism under Malone, legislation which we all sadly remember, prohibiting mixed marriages, making interracial sex illegal, classifying every individual by race, obliging people to carry passes, Separate Amenities Act, pass laws, really, as I say, institutionalized barbarity that people had to live with. And in Ways of Dying, the everyday situations which people encounter are connected with death and funerals, violence on the trains, people have to get to work on the trains, street gangs, even the necklacing of children, absolutely horrifying, children suspected of being informers. So how do we get to community, Ubuntu, agency, and life out of that particularly grim and gruesome set of ingredients? Well, in Ways of Dying, I think Mdaa does it by creating in the chief protagonist, Toloki, a man who is learning to become a professional mourner. So to mourn death effectively for the individuals left behind, whether families or communities, one has to know about life. One has to know about the life, actions, values, personality of the person who's died. I mean, we've all been to memorial services which call themselves a celebration of the life of the person, because that is crucial, isn't it, to how we remember them and what was important about them. So professional mourning, as Toloki discovers in a later novel, Sion, when he leaves South Africa, has been practiced for centuries by the ancient Greeks and Romans, and in more recent times in Spain, Italy, India, Ireland, Zambia. So death is linked to life and to culture, because the professional mourner takes on the challenge of mourning the unwanted people from society, the poor, the homeless, the loveless. So that's the first area of growth and challenge, Toloki's learning to become a professional mourner. And the second is really by showing the reader that the simplest and the least educated people, and those are most of Mdaa's characters, are capable of artistic transformation. And they have imagination, they sing, they dance, they draw, they sculpt, they carve. In other words, they have the capacity to transform their environment. So how does Mdaa achieve this revelation of artistic talent among his characters? Basically, by making us see it, this whole process of focalization. Mdaa's a very visual writer. He makes you see, and when you see, you begin to understand the world in different ways. And I want to, just before we leave Ways of Dying and move on to the Madonna and the Claire Hurd paintings, I want to just read you a little bit, often anthologized. This is the chief, the professional mourner Toloki, and his lover Noria. And what Toloki has done is to buy all kinds of magazines, and he takes the pictures out of the magazines and he puts them all in, transforms their shack into the things that the pictures show. And so starts off quite realistically, and then we sort of move into a whole dimension of fantasy and the imagination as he and his lover start to live in these spaces that they've created. So I'll just read you a little bit of this to give you a flavor of it. Toloki mixes flour and sugar that he has bought from Shadrach's spaza shop with water. He makes a paste to use for plastering the pictures from the magazines and catalogues on the wall. The walls are divided into different sections. On some sections, he plasters pictures of ideal kitchens. There are also pictures of lounges, dining rooms, and bedrooms. Then on two walls, he plasters pictures of ideal gardens and houses and swimming pools, all from Home and Garden. By the time he's finished, every inch of the wall is covered with bright pictures, a wallpaper of sheer luxury. Then Toloki takes Noria's hand and strolls with her through the grandeur. First they go to the bedroom. She runs and throws herself on the comfortable king-size bed. Toloki hesitates, but she says, "Come on, Toloki, don't be afraid. Come and sit next to me." He sits, and the soft bedding seems to swallow them. Toloki kicks his legs up, jumps up and down on the bed like an excited child. Noria kneels on the bed. They laugh like two mischievous children and fight with the continental pillows. So they move into all the different rooms of the shack and actually start to inhabit the pictures. And eventually they move to the garden, and I'll just read you that paragraph. "The whole garden is a potpourri of color, designed by expert landscape architects. Petals and scents drift above the pathways that twist and wind up the slope. The paving is made from flagstones fitted together like a jigsaw puzzle and curving around a bright bank of salvia, azaleas, petunias, and nicotiana. There are the varieties of grasses that create a natural palette of textures, rhythms, and soft colors. There are slashing brooks and waterfalls that cascade to a collecting pool. Pools and ponds are a haven for wildlife and water plants. Besides giving the place a rugged, semi-wild look, the variety of bushes and shrubs create hiding places for Noria and Toloki when they play hide and seek." So that's an illustration of one of the ways in which the novel encompasses both quite graphic social realism and suddenly launches into magic realism, where the desires and the imagination of the protagonists takes over and creates a space of creativity. So despite the horror and the gruesomeness of the setting, Ways of Dying is an extraordinarily hopeful book. It's all about how people can change their environment themselves, move into new ways of seeing and understanding the world. I want to move now to the next novel, The Madonna of Excelsior, because in that I have... Where are they? Yes. A number of the Fairhope paintings, which are very important for this novel. So perhaps I could hand these out. These are for you to keep, and I've also got some overheads, so you can each take a copy of those. Yeah. Okay, so the handouts that are circulating, the first page is a poster that was made. I went to Sweden to talk about post-colonial studies, and they made this rather nice poster of the Fairhope paintings. And on the back of them, I've put four pictures from the Schweiger book, Fairhope, Priest and Poet, would just give you some kind of picture, some sort of feeling of what it is that Ndar is working with in this ekphrosis, this turning of paintings into fiction that animates the Madonna. So the paintings, some of you may know much more about Fairhope and the Bloemfontein group than I do, but the paintings of Frans Fairhope, which are really the inspiration for the Madonna, are quite extraordinary. I mean, the paintings obviously exist. They exist in galleries, they're in catalogues. You can buy them, you can go and see them, they are very wonderful. Who was Frans Fairhope? Well, he was a missionary. He was originally Belgian, founded a Jesuit mission station in the Orange Free State amongst very, very poor practitioners. And Ndar, who met him and went to Taba Nchu, where his mission station was, takes over those paintings and builds them into his story world. Okay, so you may wonder if you've read The Madonna and looked at it, where are these illustrations? Where are the paintings? And of course, there are no paintings given in the story, apart from these little kind of postage stamp pictures at the beginning of each chapter. Otherwise, you've got what looks like part of a painting on the front cover and what looks like part of a painting on the back cover, but you can't actually identify the painting at all. So how do we know that these are the paintings that he's talking about, and you know, what's the basis for our the authority of understanding what the connection between Fairhope's paintings and Ndar's story world is? Well, as you start to read the text, so you get more and more detailed and very clear descriptions of the paintings. You've only got to find a catalogue of Fairhope paintings to think, oh yeah, this is the Blue Madonna. Oh yes, this is the boy riding backwards. You know, this, the descriptions are perfectly clear. But you know, the more interesting question is really, why does he do it? You know, why does he want to appropriate Fairhope's paintings for his novel? What does he want to show the reader through these processes of focalization? And I think what he wants to show us is the contrast. Okay, the contrast between the miscegenation trial, which is another a pretty grim and awful episode in apartheid history. You'll probably know the background. White farmers raping their black servants, creating a whole generation of coloured children who were accepted by neither the white nor the black. And the black servants really taking the brunt of the... Because the white Afrikaans farmers had lawyers and they had money and they got off pretty scot-free. The black women molded in jail with their children. So in a very nasty episode. And the characters in the Madonna, Nikki and Popey, Nikki's the mother, Popey's the daughter, really take the whole novel to recover from those beginnings and to find themselves and to individuate themselves. But then what's the connection with Claire Haute? Well, you see, they are models. They go to Claire Haute's studio and they model for Claire Haute as Madonna and child. And you have to imagine Claire Haute in his studio surrounded by all of these paintings of Madonnas and children and, you know, with some models sitting there inspiring the paintings. So what the whole novel is based on is something to do with, I think, the contrast between the vision that Claire Haute has, which is a non-sexist, non-racist vision of nurturing and compassion and sharing. And that is juxtaposed against what you see in the miscegenation trial. And again, what he does here is he lifts bits of media journalism from a newspaper called The Friend in Bloemfontein, which was reporting on the miscegenation trial. And what you have reflected there is the narrowness and the hypocrisy and the racism of apartheid. Okay, so the juxtaposition between that vision of the world and Claire Haute's vision of the world, which is very strikingly different. So how does Mdawa link his story world to that of Claire Haute's paintings? Well, by setting the novel in the small Free State town of Excelsior, which is where the infamous miscegenation trial took place. So maybe we should now look at some of the overheads and talk about them. The first couple have to do with the setting, which is what surrounds Claire Haute and what he is influenced by in the pictures that he makes of the scenery, the landscape, the flowers, the people. So, of course, what you see in the first one is the sunflowers, you know, fields of sunflowers as far as the eye can see, which feed into the colours of Claire Haute's painting, the yellows and the blues and the red of the earth. So the fields of sunflowers, and here we have the fields of cosmos. I'm sure you've all seen these in the Free State. Yes, enormous horizons of pink going into the mountains. And there you have, at the bottom right-hand corner, a picture of Claire Haute himself. And this is what the text tells us about him. In 1979, for my glasses, never mind, while in Belgium. Oh, thank you very much. Okay. While in Belgium, Frans Claire Haute suffered a heart attack. After a bypass operation in Bloemfontein later that year, he experienced what he likes to call his second lease on life. His work becomes even more colourful, his colours radiating his warmth for and love of South Africa. I see through African eyes with a touch of Belgium here and there. After all, you can't put your heritage in a plastic bag and throw it out the window. So what is very fascinating as we look at the paintings is that African vision that still takes something from Europe. Okay, so the first painting I want to show you is this one. So here we have the familiar colours of earth and sky that dominate Claire Hurt's paintings, of the red of the soil below the donkey, the boy's clothes, the yellow of the donkey and the sunflowers, the blue of the sky. But why is he riding backwards? Why not? This is Claire Hurt's distorted, symbolist, expressionist world. And what it makes us see is the figures of the paintings, which, you know, like Imdar's characters, are in a different kind of reality. We're brought into a way of seeing that goes beyond realism to include dreams and the imagination. So, similarly, the next painting, which is all about the harvest, and where you have the same colours, the yellow and the blue and the red, which are the dominant colours here. Everywhere, of course, sunflowers in evidence, colours and forms which suggest a closeness to the life of the earth. And of course, think about sunflowers. They're quite unlike, say, cotton plantations in the United States, you know, where slaves gave their labor to create a cash crop which gave nothing to them. Sunflowers give oil and seeds, you know, so there's something nurturing about them. The next painting I want to show you is, I think, a very extraordinary one. I've called it Eyes in the Sky. Okay, unfortunately, colours are not coming out very well, but you've got the Nativity here, Mary and Joseph and the baby and the barn, and then standing on the roof of the barn is a figure in a red hat, surrounded by all these faces, little faces looking down on the Nativity. Okay, and I think what this shows us is this quite fascinating combination of the African and the European, because I think that this is very much a convention that comes out of Renaissance paintings. You know, if you know the paintings of Piero della Francesco, they are full of saints and angels looking down on the Nativity and commenting on it. Okay, and this is a kind of ironic take on that, because the figures in the sky are not saints or angels, they're very human. And they're very much involved in the rather kind of skinnering perspective, you know, as the neighbours of Nicky and Popey, not really quite approving of them, making some quite sarcastic remarks and so on. So, you know, they're only partly admiring, they are actually very, very human. So they are the neighbours in Malahuetza Township, which is where Nikki and Popey come from. Okay, not angelic, but very human, all too human. Okay, so that community looking down on the Nativity, you can think of as the neighbours of Nikki, who don't fully support or understand her because they are themselves the victims of apartheid. She has to make her own way in the novel, as does her daughter, not very strongly supported by the people around her. Okay, then finally we have a suite of musicians. The figures playing the penny whistle here, or strumming the banjo. Okay. And this one, I'm not sure what the instrument that he's playing is, whether again it's a penny whistle. Okay. But a musician's very much beloved of Claire Hurt and very much beloved of Ndaw. You know, this novel actually ends up with singing and dancing. It starts off very grimly with the rape of the women in the sunflower season. At the end, you have the same women now taking charge of their destiny, now moving into a new world, and there's singing and there's dancing and there's community festival all around them. Okay, so perhaps we could finish by looking at the paintings in your handout. To the three we've already touched on, there's another one, the Blue Madonna at the bottom right, which again I think shows Claire Hurt's African inspiration in relation to his European background. Very different, isn't it, from the Madonnas of the Renaissance, set in, you know, wonderful architectural settings. This Madonna is quite somatic, quite embodied. She's wrapped in the contemplation of her child, and she and the child take up the whole painting. Nothing else matters. She exudes tenderness. On the reverse of the page, you have several paintings. The first is of a purple church, which the narrator tells us is Nikki's church. People walk out of the skewed houses. Now, the congregation in this church, unlike the whites-only church, is very poor. And, you know, the minister is making a sermon about trying to exhort them to contribute, but there's only little brown pennies that land up in the collection bowl. Nevertheless, when you look at that painting, you can see the force of the fervor and the joy of these simple, non-literate parishioners, very much like the people in Claire Hurt's parish, quite different from the affluent Afrikaans, Calvinist, white people's church. Here we have this sort of sense of the purity of the beliefs and hopes that they carry, perhaps suggested in the white flowers. The next painting of the figure enfolding the sun is called Catcher of the Sun, and it shows a woman, as you see, clasping in her arms the globe of the sun, which gives life to the sunflowers, but which can also scorch the earth in droughts. So the closeness between the woman and the sun suggests very interestingly that the son is a maternal rather than paternal figure. Okay, and very different from, if you think about the hymn that St. Francis wrote, brother, son, and sister, moon. This one actually insists on the creativity of the female. And that is the story from the very first line of the novel, you know, all about the sins of the mothers. It's insisting on the creativity of the female, who is too often marginalized or instrumentalized in Western culture. So, at the bottom left, we have the three musicians, figure in the purple overalls, pink hat, purple shoes, playing a squash box or a concertina, the blue-green figure in the middle. The figure on the right in red, strumming the banjo. All of them communicating a power to change the world through their art. And the novel ends, as I said, with singing and dancing in the very same sunflower seeds as it started off by showing us the rape of the women. The last painting on the sheet shows a giant in a red hat carrying a star. Again, all these little houses, and little people in houses. And this one, I think, is particularly interesting in that what it shows us is the importance, I think, of that figure is actually to suggest something about the oral tradition, because you know, what you have celebrated and fused here is the past and the present, the real and the imaginary, categories which in orature are not kept apart as they are in Western art. And so Mda is borrowing the giant with the star in order to enrich the community with the ideas and the vision which can, you know, most enhance their lives. Okay, I think I should probably stop there if I'm going to give you time for questions and comments. Please ask about anything, or you know, what we'll do tomorrow is to go on to the other three novels and finish up with various things to do with quilt making, because I think that Mda is always very interested in the processes of art and the way in which people move forward through new imaginative holes, and he does that in Sion. But is there anything that we've talked about so far that people want to ask about in either Ways of Dying or the Madonna or the Claire Hood paintings? Yeah.
I'm very curious about him as a painter. According to the book, he himself is a renowned painter, and I wondered if he had any examples of his own art. Yeah. How it relates to this.
Sorry, what you're asking about is...
Is Mda as a painter, as well as...
He is a painter. In fact, there's... I could find the book which I was reading from, so it can't be very far. It has to be here somewhere. Where's it hiding? Here it is. The middle of the book has a whole, and in fact these are beautiful, they really have come out most beautifully. There's the Claire Hote in his studio and then various of his paintings. And at the end I have put this painting, which is by Mda. Because when I wrote to him, I said, you know, do you have a website? Because I knew he was a painter. Can I get hold of a painting?
And he said, well, write to these friends of mine in Barcelona, they've got a picture, and they sent me this one. And you can see, you know, a lot of the kind of distorted expressionist elements that, you know, he has in common with Claire Holt. So, I mean, this is one of the most important things about Andal, I think. You know, the visual imagination in what he's writing about comes out of the fact that he is a painter. And he is a theatre practitioner. You know, all those years, he worked with the Maratoli Traveling Theatre in Lesotho, and what he was trying to do was to teach people about how to understand, how to take part in government, how to explore issues of democracy and so on, but, you know, rather than preaching at them, getting them to enact their own interests and preoccupations and needs. And so, you know, a very dramatic, a very performance-centered kind of art, which he then translates into these novels, which start with Ways of Dying, the very first South African novel. When Andal came out about a year and a half ago to launch Black Diamond, that had just come out with Penguin, I said to him, I had a couple of interviews, and I said, well, you know, you've been a theatre practitioner, you are a critic, now you are a novelist. What's the relationship between these three areas? And he said basically, well, you tell me. You know, I'm the creative artist, I do the painting, I write the plays, I write the novels, and you critics can talk about, you know, how it all comes together. So he's very cagey about, he doesn't want to be tied down to sort of theoretical ideas, but what he is very, very interesting in is sharing. This is why you might enjoy the autobiography, Sometimes There Is a Void, because all his writing actually comes out of where he's lived, where he's been, who he's known, you know, the impacts of those very personal things on him. And it's actually very generous, because when I spoke to him, I said it was a year and a half ago, and he hadn't finished writing the autobiography. But he said, I've written the first three chapters, would you like those? And they gave them to me, and they were very useful because they were all about the first years, you know, the transition from Soweto to Lesotho and his schooling. So they were very, very useful. And it shows a kind of, I think, typical generosity on his part, you know, that he'll share whatever he's got with you if you're interested in his work. And, you know, I suppose I'm telling you this because I think that there's a difference between, you know, the creative faculty and the critical faculty, and it's not fair to expect writers to, you know, engage theoretically with their work. If they're prepared to share some of the processes which, you know, actually animate the work. He's in many ways the opposite of J.M. Coetzee, for instance, you know, a writer who has engaged very, very extensively and theoretically with all the issues that he works out in his fiction, and does not like that. But I think he writes the most extraordinarily interesting, versatile, extraordinarily different sort of fiction, because you emerge from it. You know, we've talked about the really very depressing sociological aspects of Ways of Dying, the Madonna, you know, all about apartheid. How can you make a story of hope and life out of that? But he does. And he does that in every single one of his novels. And you come to
The Heart of Redness tomorrow. That's the story of the Balsa cattle killing, which, you know, has been described as the greatest disaster in Balsa history because hundreds of thousands of people died. So how can you make that into a story of hope? But he does. What he does is say, right, we will move to the descendants of those people in the same place in the Eastern Cape and allow them to take charge of their future, to make decisions about how they're going to work together to create a better world. Well, it's a very, to me, a very important part of Mandela's work that you come away from it as a South African filled with wonder and hope, you know, that people actually can work together, that the creative imagination does mean something, that people can leave behind some of the limitations of their situation and be creative. And you know, to me, that is a very moving thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Given his optimism about South Africa, he thought of why he lives in the States.
Why he lives in the States? Well, that's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
He's
not very optimistic.
No.
He's pessimistic about South Africa. I think he's
autobiography. Come back. You know, I think a lot of his living in the States is to do with the fact that you know, given his optimism and his hope for South Africa, he's not at all ideologically aligned with any power group. Okay, so you look at Black Diamond, which is all about black economic empowerment, which his ex really has no time for at all. And you realize that, you know, there isn't a niche which he easily fills because he is quite even-handed in the way that he will show the victims of apartheid, who may be white, who may be black. You know, he emphasizes and he doesn't judge. So I think there's an ideological problem that, you know, he's actually fated in the States as a writer and can come back to South Africa and has connections here. And another thing that is, I think, a factor is the autobiographical one. You know, his father was a PAC activist and you know, a very inspiring person, and I think that Mdaw feels rather overshadowed by the legacy of his father. I don't know. There are also all kinds of, if you read the autobiography, family dramas and wives and children. And you know, if you look at it, it's a pattern, isn't it, of African writers going overseas and, you know, finding a space for themselves in which they can carry on kind of talking to people back home. But a space where they are better affirmed than they would be in South Africa, which I think is probably Mdaw's case. But I think, you know, he does have very a very optimistic kind of idea of what we as South Africans can create together. But, you know, having said that, I don't think it's at all idealized or utopian or sentimental. You know, he's not saying the way ahead is easy. And if you look at the end of The Heart of Redness, you have the possibility of creation of a new ecological future. But it's quite uncertain. You know, you might suddenly have a government fiat that you know, decides to build a casino in Pelora and everything will be destroyed. There aren't any easy solutions, but there are responsible and responsive people who have all kinds of interesting
ideas and ideals for the country, and that I think is very worthwhile. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else people want to ask about or point out, or anyone running off somewhere else? Then, so it's same time, same place tomorrow, and we look at some different novels. And are any of you quilters? Any of you make tapestries, quilts? You do. Oh, that's very interesting. And I shall call upon you to take us through some of those, because it is fascinating.
Nothing.
Thank you very much.